I'm Fiona Woods. I'm the Vice President of Blind Citizens Australia. I'm coming to you from the lands of the Dharug and Gundungurra people here in the Blue Mountains. And I'd like first, before we get going, to hand over to Stephen Belbin. Stephen Belbin is the Director with Blind Citizens Australia, and he's the Chair of our Stakeholder Engagement Committee, and he's going to deliver an acknowledgement of country. Thanks,
Thanks, Fiona.
Stephen.
Thank you. My name's Stephen, and I myself am a proud Aboriginal man. My people are the Berrigal people, which are located in Sydney, on the northern beaches of Sydney. I'm currently on Warramai country here in Port Stephens, New South Wales. I'd like just quickly to take this opportunity to acknowledge the importance of this week for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and indeed all Australians, to come together. It's National Reconciliation Week, which usually runs from the 27th of May through 3rd June. Besides having lots of important opportunities and events to reflect and move forward, it's also about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people sharing their experiences and moving forward with the greater Australian population. And I'd like to also say that the theme this year is more than a word. And I think that more than a word and taking action, I think that it is more than a word. It's very, very challenging to be able to share 60,000 years of heritage and information and with everyone, but we'll certainly give it a go. And I think the importance of it is to share it with all Australians and to be able to move forward, because we are one and we are all Australians. So at that particular point, I'd like to take the opportunity to proudly acknowledge the traditional lands on which all of us are meeting through this virtual space, and also acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that may be present here in the meeting. I'd like to also share my deep connection to land, sea, and community, and show my respect and embrace all Aboriginal elders, past, present, and future. Thank you, and over to you, Fiona.
Thank you, Stephen. I'd also like to give my respects to any Aboriginal people here today. Today is our second BCA Connect, our virtual conference, and we've got a fantastic lineup of speakers, panel presenters, and topics. I'm particularly pleased to have something to offer our Victorian members here today who, you know, seem to have missed out on all the other opportunities. I'd like to thank all the staff of BCA who've worked very hard to put today together, and especially those in Victoria who've kept going with planning this event, even though the rest of their lives have been thrown into chaos. I will just mention to everyone that you are all on Zoom today. We did talk about setting up some hubs, but it seems that our first BCA Connect was such an overwhelming success that everyone or most people opted to attend again via Zoom. So in fact, the hubs didn't go ahead. And in fact, in Melbourne, it's just as well we didn't plan to do them, because it would have been a waste of effort. But now we are here, all here on Zoom, in the comfort and warmth of our own environments. You've got uninterrupted access to coffee and whatever snacks you want, and toilets. There's no queues. So it's great to have everyone here. As with all major BCA events, today's sessions will all be recorded, and they'll be available within the next few days on the BCA website. To help things run smoothly today, there's just a few things I would like to outline to you all, and then we'll go for a roll call, which I know is always a big highlight. Currently everyone is on mute. You are able to ask questions, but if you want to ask questions, please raise your hand. You can do this by pressing Alt-Y on your computer keypad, or by pressing *9 on the telephone. And then our Zoom team, which is BCA staff, will be monitoring for hands raised, and they will prompt you when it's time for you to ask your question. At that point, you'll be able to, if you could unmute yourself. You can unmute by pressing Alt-A on your computer keyboard or *6 on your phone. Then you'll be able to talk. But please remember to return to mute when you finish speaking. And today will really only work if people stick to mute unless they have been prompted to ask a question, or unless they're a panel presenter. Alternatively, you can text questions to 0436 446 780 and someone will read them out for you. If you have any technical issues, you can call BCA on 1-800-033-660, or you can email bca@bca.org.au. I feel like we should have a little jingle we could just press like they do on the radio. BCA is being live captioned. If you would like to access the captions, you can do this by pressing the closed caption button on your screen. The Lee, who is our stenographer, will also be putting a link in the chat now for those who wish to access captions on a separate screen or device. And I know I've just said we're putting a link in the chat, but the chat function can be very distracting for people using screen readers, even though it can be very useful. So we've asked people not to use the chat feature generally. There, see, there's the text. If you have information to share, please email it to BCA and it can get distributed after the event. People are encouraged to stay in the meeting all day. You can come and go as it suits you, obviously, because you're in your own place, but don't feel that you need to log out every time and then put yourself back in and go through the whole waiting procedure again. It's fine to just, you know, stay on mute and do whatever it is that you want to do while still listening. I'm now going to hand over to Naomi for a roll call.
Thanks so much, Fiona. Good morning, everybody. Naomi from BCA here, just running through a quick roll call. While we have tried to rename people that have come in on landlines and mobile phones, I apologise if we haven't gotten to you and we may miss reading your name out, but we'll go through the list now. We have with us today Andrew. We have Andrew's iPhone, Angela Jeschke, BCA staff, Brendan Donoghue, Kathy Horner, Chelsea Bartlett, Chris Edwards, Christine Simpson, Connor S., David Gledhill, Deborah, Doug, L. Gibbs, Emma Benison, BCA, Erica, Fiona Woods, Francois Jacobs, Gerard, Graham Innes, Helen Ferris, Jan Miller, Jane Britt, BCA, Janej on the iPhone, Jackie Bond, Jennifer Parry, BCA, John Simpson, Geordie Howell, Joyce, Julianne Bell, Karen Knight, Kathy Elliott, Katrina Taylor, Kevin Murfitt, Kristen Busby, Lauren Henley, Lee Smith, Lynn Eagers, Michael Board, Miriam, BCA, Neil, Nicole, Patrick Edwards, Paul Price, Pauline Cornell, Payal Patel, Prue Watt, Ramona Mandy, Robin McKenzie, Rory Tudor, BCA, Sally Orish, BCA, Samantha Marsh, BCA, Scott Erickson, Stephanie Mitchell, Stephen Belbin, Steve Patterson, Susan Thompson, Susie Rich, Terry Boyle, Tim Haggis, BCA, Tony Grant, BCA, Tristan Clare, Vaughan Benison, Wayne Hawkins, and Wendy on the iPhone. And that's us at 71 participants at the moment. Thanks, Fiona.
Thanks, Naomi. It's great to hear such a cast of familiar and not so familiar names, but it's wonderful that so many people are here. If you're a Twitter user, please feel free to tweet about BCA Connect using the hashtag BCA Connect. Now I'd like to hand over to a man who needs no introduction, our president, John Simpson.
Thanks, Fiona, and good morning, everyone. From a cold and lockdown Euroa in country Victoria. It's great to see more than 70 people here at this early hour of the morning, and I know that there are others that will join us during the day. Today, we celebrate another milestone for our organisation with the conduct of this, our second virtual convention. This is an initiative that has been designed to provide connection between our members in order that the organisation can better understand your needs and that you have the opportunity to learn and to share experiences with each other. Today we're going to hear about the importance of speaking out on matters that negatively impact our lives. We'll review progress on our long-standing quest for an independent, secret and verifiable vote. And we'll look at issues including communications technology developments, wayfinding, and then talk about the challenges of self and value of self-employment for those of us who choose that path. These are just some, of course, of the various policy and advocacy issues that the organisation is involved in as the national representative voice of people who are blind or vision impaired. And they're all areas that depend on the support and the input that we get from you, our members, and from other members of the blind and vision impaired community. Because, of course, without that input, BCA is not able to effectively represent the community that we're here to serve. When I talk about celebrations, there's much for us to reflect on with the organisation in recent times, and I'll just take a couple of seconds to touch on some of the important things that have happened since we last met. We now have in place formal partnership agreements with many of the major service providers across the country, and in fact, with service providers in every state and territory. These include Vision Australia, Guide Dogs Australia, and through Guide Dogs Australia, their member organisations in Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, and South Australia, and with Visibility, who are now functioning in Western Australia and Tasmania. And we're working to extend that arrangement with other major organisations. Recently, our submission to the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters regarding the last New South Wales state election was heard at the Standing Committee inquiry in New South Wales, and our recommendations were put forward in the final report. Our executive leadership program is now well underway with members participating in that program. I think the group has now met three times and is hard at work with the various project activities and other involvements that come with that program. And of course, as an extension of that, we recently saw some of our staff members step up into more senior roles, with Sally acting as CEO and Jane acting as general manager of engagement and projects. We're opening and successfully concluding more and more individual advocacy cases as time rolls on. And some of these, of course, come to us directly, and many others come through referral from those partner organisations that I took to. Not only are we increasingly opening cases, but we're increasingly successfully resolving cases. And that's a real feature of the organisation's work, and one that is so vital to supporting the people in the blind and low vision community. We're rolling out both our Skills Exchange and Peer Connect programs to enhance opportunities for our members to come together and to learn from each other in smaller groups. Our TV for All campaign is in a new phase, with a petition that has already seen more than 600 signatures and the support of just a small organisation called Telstra that has given us access to promote the TV for All campaign through their various retail outlets, with an opportunity for people to sign a petition in those situations. We have recently signed a grant deed for another another grant program that will allow us to extend our eye to the future employment program. As I heard Vaughan and Graeme Innes reflecting in the pre-program, the BCA Hugh Jeffrey Scholarship Program has now been launched, and there's an opportunity there for up to five people in this first round to have scholarship support to complete an education program this year or next year. We've received some incredibly generous donations, and we do thank those individuals and organisations that demonstrate their support for our organisations through our donation programs. And most recently, and a most important element of our development, is the conduct last Thursday night of a very special happy hour where we talked about Reconciliation Week, and Tim Haggis led that program and interviewed June Reimer from First Peoples Disability Network. And that was a fantastic opportunity for us to extend our knowledge in that area. And of course, these are just some of the things that that we are undertaking and will continue to undertake to represent and to support our membership. I also heard Vaughan and Graeme in the pre-program talking a lot about our various communications media, and I remind you that we offer a wide variety of opportunities for people to connect with the organisation through BC News, through our weekly New Horizons radio program, social media, our telephone system, and all of those things. And all of these things are designed to ensure that BCA's work is undertaken in a way that is fully integrated with the actual needs and aspirations of people who are blind or vision impaired. But of course, all of our work can only be successful if we have that input. So as part of today's BCA Connect program, I encourage you to participate fully in the discussions on those key subjects and more broadly to actually respond through our various communications media, like the weekly update and so forth, to requests for input on the subjects that are of importance and interest to you. Because without your input, we can't do the job that we're here to do. So with that said, and more immediately, I want to welcome you all to this, our second BCA Connect. And on behalf of you all, I want to thank the staff team and Fiona for the fantastic job that they've done in bringing this day to fruition. So with those few words, Fiona, it's back to you, and let's get on with the day's event.
Thank you, John. And let's get on with session one, which is raising your voice, but of course it's really our voice. It's now my pleasure to introduce Elle Gibbs. Elle is a disability advocate and writer. She's a senior media and policy advisor for First Peoples Disability Network. Just last week, Elle was awarded a fellowship through Varuna Australia, which will enable her to begin writing a book on the NDIS later this year. Now, this mystified me. I'm very intrigued. I don't know if it'll be a novel or if it will be one of those things where truth is stranger than fiction. But I think there could be an interesting cast of characters, a very complicated plot where very hard to predict and no one knows what's going to happen, and I think you'd have to choose your own ending. From what I've read, from what Elle's written previously, I doubt very much that it will be a love story. Elle has long been involved with many disability advocacy campaigns, and we're very thrilled to have her here today to talk to us and to provide the keynote address. Thank you, Elle.
Thank you so much, Fiona. Before I get started, I'm coming to you today from unceded Wiradjuri country in central west New South Wales, and I pay my respect to elders past and present and to any and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability who are here today. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. And I thank Stephen very much for your acknowledgement as well. Big thanks to you all, to everyone at BCA, for the invitation to chat with you today and welcoming me to your conference. As Fiona said, my name's Elle, and I write lots of things. I'm a general troublemaker on Twitter as well. I'm a white middle-aged woman with medium-length grey-brown hair, and it's in a bun today, and I wear glasses. I'm wearing a stripy top and grey check vest, and there's a bookshelf behind me. Today, I want to talk a bit about how disabled people together get shit done. I'm going to use mostly identity-first language, which is also how I talk about myself. And I'm going to talk about the Disability Royal Commission and some general themes of neglect and abuse, but no specific details. So that's the content warning for you. I've reflected a lot over the last year about the strength and power of disabled people as we worked so damn hard to make sure our community was okay during COVID. I've thought long and hard about what worked and what didn't and what it all means for the fights we are still to have to truly be equal. In March last year, I had a conversation with my GP that I know that many other disabled people also had. She confirmed that COVID was a huge threat to me, and I had to isolate myself as soon as possible. So 2 weeks before the national lockdown, I closed the door to my flat and I didn't leave for over 4 months. I was lucky in many ways, and by July, I could get out and about again. but many other disabled people were locked down for much longer, particularly people in Melbourne. And I'm thinking of you this week. My experiences during COVID were the same as for many other disabled people. I couldn't get food, my disability support stopped. I had battles with many of the ways that I've used to stay independent. My individual experience was also a shared one. Many parts of our community were also in the same boat. Reliable information was really hard to find. Announcements were made by governments at blistering speed, with rules changing every day, as well as the blizzard of scientific and health updates. But there always seemed to be the missing information about us, what it meant for our community. All of this was incredibly scary and confusing, and to be frank, infuriating. During the first few months of the pandemic, specific guidance for disabled people was absent. The various departments of health didn't include us and barely made things accessible. Government agencies like the NDIS and the Quality and Safeguards Commission made sure that disability providers had updates, but not us. We saw overseas that there were guidelines that triaged us out of healthcare and that disabled people were given do not resuscitate orders. In response, our community, as always, rallied to fill the gaps. At the grassroots level, we created the Disability and Chronic Illness COVID Information Clearinghouse group on Facebook to coordinate information and to help each other. Posts were made about finding groceries, accessible information, information about lockdown rules, how to stay safe with support workers, and where to get personal protective equipment, and much, much more. Community members shared what worked for them. They called and emailed government agencies and then posted that back in the group. Lobbied supermarkets, figured out workarounds, and shared it all with each other. They supported people who were alone, people who were scared, and people who had nothing. We translated government updates into plain English. We summarised changes to income support and lockdown rules, which updated support information, all in the face of utter neglect from levels of government. On the ground, disabled people worked together to share resources, to get food to people, sanitizer and masks, through mutual aid and partnering with other organisations. For example, in New South Wales, staff from the First Peoples Disability Network worked with community organisations to make and deliver over 2,000 emergency care packages throughout Dubbo and the Greater New South Wales Western Region. BCA, I know, delivered online updates every week, as did some other organisations. In my day job at the time as Director of Media and Comms at People with Disability Australia, we worked really hard to make sure the website had up-to-date information. We coordinated with other communication staff, including from BCA, from other national disabled people's organisations and disability representative organisations. We lobbied hard to the federal government about disabled people being left out of the COVID response, both publicly and privately. Eventually, all this work paid off and we started to be included. Plans were made by different levels of government and a small amount of consideration was given to disabled people. But as we now know, this was but a fig leaf on an entire government's neglect of us, our families and community during COVID, and continuing now during the vaccine rollout. The Disability Royal Commission, the DRC, held a hearing about all this last year and released a report and then held another hearing into the vaccine rollout last week. All these found the same thing, that disabled people had been overlooked, ignored, and forgotten in the pandemic planning. Response now and again with the vaccine. And I'll be honest with you, I got really upset hearing from the Senior Department of Health person last week that we just hadn't been considered again. The DRC COVID report last year found that no agency of the Australian government, including the Department of Health and other agencies responsible for disability policy, made any significant effort to consult with people with disability or their representative organisations. None. The DRC says this excluded disabled people from planning and led to increased stress, anxiety and distress, which seems like a bit of an understatement. They also found that there needs to be a unit inside the health department which specifically looks at the health of disabled people, almost as though we're actually people who matter. But did that happen? Did governments learn from that experience, from that report, from being yelled at by disabled people for a year? Not really, but this time the response was quick and fierce and we got change. As the vaccine has rolled out, disabled people have come together to figure out both how to get the vaccine and to share how our bodies are responding to it. Collectively, groups of disabled and chronically ill people have shared updates and symptoms, talking about navigating booking systems and figuring out the latest scientific information. Sound familiar? Again, our community has been doing this for ourselves while governments exclude us. I know I'm not the only person doing quantum levels of risk calculations about different vaccines and timeframes. I got my first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine this week after lots of conversations with disabled people and my doctor. And there hasn't been any information, official information, to help me make that decision. We heard from the DRC hearing a week or so back about the vaccine rollout, that disabled people who live in group homes, who've been on lockdown for so bloody long, aren't getting the vaccine as promised. When questioned, the health department admitted they just decided not to prioritise us and also hadn't let anyone know. If you can hear that I'm angry about this, you're correct. I'm really angry that we don't seem to count, that we aren't being listened to, and I'm angry that the same mistakes keep happening over and over again. The work that got the attention of government last year was multifaceted, coordinated, and relentless. This work was led by disabled people, by our experiences, by our skills at getting shit done. And this is what is happening again with the vaccine rollout. Disabled people and disability organisations have rallied to put huge pressure on governments to get this vaccine rollout moving and to deliver vaccines to disabled people in group homes and in the community. It's starting now to work. This work, this community activism and the advocacy of disabled people's organisations isn't new, and it has a long history. Disabled people have come together to fight for their rights over decades, and we are part of that history and in debt to those who've come before us. Some of the earliest fights for disability rights were the fights to be included and not to live in segregated environments. That means the right to be included in the workplace, to live in the community like everyone else, to catch the train, to go to the footy, to do the things that non-disabled people take for granted. This fight has always pushed back on the idea that disabled people are broken or we need to be fixed or shut away. In 1983, the federal government review of handicapped programs found that almost all of the disabled participants in the review, regardless of the nature of their disability, wanted improved access to mainstream services rather than the further development of segregated services. In his 1991 Mears Oration, Uncle Lester Bostock, one of the founders of the then Aboriginal Disability Network, now the First Peoples Disability Network, talked about his decades of activism fighting for the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability. He talks about the double disadvantage that community experiences, and how having First Peoples with Disability leading organisations and talked about as human beings with human value and human dignity are vital for change. Disabled people fought to have organisations of our own, insisting that we know best about what happens to us and have the right to self-determination. Strong campaigns driven by disabled people advocated for the end of institutions and for more community-based supports, as well as for the entrenching of our rights, such as through the Disability Services Act and the Disability Discrimination Act. Disabled people insisted that we should be the ones in charge of what happens to us, that we should be in control of our own lives, that we had to be the ones who were heard. Disabled people took control from organisations that had spoken for us or just started new ones. What all these organisations have insisted of is that we are in charge of what happens to us and that non-disabled people can't be in control of our lives. In the 2000s, another grouping formed, this time an alliance of disabled people, families, carers and service providers, to lobby and advocate for significant change in the way disabled people get our supports, what we now know of as the NDIS. This campaign reshaped how non-disabled people understand disability supports. The work was done in a sustained way to build that understanding that for many of us, these disability supports are essential services that everyone needs to contribute to, like education and healthcare. The links between COVID and the campaign for the NDIS might seem a bit tenuous, but stick with me. What these two moments in time share are the work of disabled people to push hard for our rights to count as equal citizens. The coordinated campaign for the NDIS changed how non-disabled people saw us, as well as how they understand the supports that we use. During COVID, we also had to come together to get people to understand what disabled people needed, why it mattered, and to change how people saw us. During COVID, we refused to be seen as expendable, as not equal, as somehow not having the same rights as non-disabled people to be safe from a disaster. During COVID, we worked together to insist on a seat at the table, to be involved in decisions about our lives. This work that we've done during COVID and are still doing now is the work that disabled people did to fight for and win the NDIS. It's the work that disabled people did to win the Disability Discrimination Act. It's the work disabled people did to get the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. It's the work disabled people did to free themselves from institutions. The work that we are capable of doing together is extraordinary, and we are doing it all over again now in fighting against the proposed changes to the NDIS. I'm often in awe of the power of disabled people to make change because I see it every single day. We are fierce campaigners, problem solvers, innovators, and most of all, we're stronger when we work with other disabled people to build a future where we are equal and included. Thanks again for having me today.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that, Elle. That's very inspiring. I think all of us in BCA are very proud of the history that BCA has of making change. But I think the last two things that you've talked about, COVID and the NDIS, show us exactly how much more strength and ability we have if we work together with other people with disability and unite in strength. And I think there'll be more of those things. I think there's plenty more battles coming up with the NDIS, but all sorts of other areas where we can bring about positive change for everybody, all people with disability and all community generally.
Absolutely. And look, yeah. I'm really happy to talk about the NDIS book, but also to answer any questions and to talk about some of the things that worked around the COVID response that we did together, and what lessons we can learn from that to fight against independent assessments and some of the other the proposed changes around the NDIS.
Yeah. Perhaps I should ask Naomi if there are any questions or any hands raised.
At this stage, I don't see any hands raised, but as we are taking questions, if you would like to raise your hand, please do so, and we can come to ask your question. Okay, Kathy Horner has raised her hand and has a question. So, Kathy, I'm just going to unmute you. There you go, Kathy.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to say what a great speech it was. Covered everything. I mean,
thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And keep it up.
Thank you, Kathy. Anyone else? I think unraising the hand is sometimes a bit of a challenge for some of us. I'm not quite sure about that.
Emma Benetton has her hand up.
Well, we'll give her permission to speak.
Thank you. Hi, Elle. How are you going? I just wanted to ask what your thoughts are, not so much on the NDIS policy, because I think I can predict that, but I'm interested to know what your thoughts are on how best disability representative organisations and disabled people can come together to deal with some of these issues, and what particular campaign strategies you might be thinking about, because I know you have exceptional strategic campaign ideas. So, and I certainly have been mulling this over quite a lot. So I'm just interested to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah. Look, thanks heaps, Emma. I appreciate that, and to saying kind things about me. I think one of the things that our community underestimates a lot is how powerful we actually are, and how much power we have to influence political change. I'm often talking with non-disabled people in the progressive sphere who talk about how hard it is to win things because we have a conservative government. And I kind of look at them going, I guess disabled people winning stuff doesn't count then. You know, we've managed to get a, you know, multi-billion dollar disability support system in place, a disability royal commission, a whole bunch of other changes because we have been able to campaign really well. But I think we underestimate how powerful we are as a community, and we often don't have the resources to be able to do some strategic campaigning. So one of the key things that I think we can do more of is flex that political muscle a bit more overtly. So being in contact with MPs and senators from the coalition a bit more and being more direct about what we want, and pushing back hard on notions of service providers, non-disabled people having kind of much, they have a lot more of government's ear than we do. And I think it's really good for us to be able to flex a bit more of our disabled muscles to, you know, push back around that kind of stuff directly. So, you know, I mean, I am, you know, slightly infamous for having long-standing correspondence with conservative senators about a variety of issues, and I'm quite sure I'm in various databases with "Oh God, not her again," written next to my name. So, but yeah, I mean, I think basic things like visiting MPs, writing letters, those kind of things can be really helpful. Get a marginal seat list and, you know, work with members who live in those marginal electorates to very much target those MPs, and stress that it's our right to have a say over what happens to us. I think the Disability Royal Commission evidence this week about Sunnyfield, a disability provider in Western Sydney, has been, you know, incredibly shocking for those of us who want more out of the NDIS. People who live in Sunnyfield group homes go to Sunnyfield day programs. They work in Sunnyfield ADEs and their supports are provided by Sunnyfield support programs. They have no choice. They have no control. And, you know, these providers get to set far too many of the rules. So I think it's kind of time for us to do more of that political power muscle flexing, and, you know, taking it up directly to government and reminding us of how many of us there actually are. And, for example, we got a pause, that pause, brief pause on the independent assessments, partly because 4,000 disabled people and their families sent emails to the new Minister Reynolds over a weekend. That's a lot when it comes to the volumes of emails that politicians get. That's a huge amount. So the fact that we can deliver that kind of response shows politicians that they need to take us more seriously.
Thanks, Elle. I'm living here in the Hawkesbury, which is, I think, one of the more marginal seats in Australia, so I might take some inspiration from that. Any more questions?
We are, I thought we are neighbours. I'm just down the road, so, but no longer okay. in the Macquarie marginal seat, yes.
Yes.
We'd like to call on Julianne Bell, who has a question.
Hi, Elle. It's lovely to meet you, even if it's virtually. I've watched your work for a very long time with great admiration. I think you're amazing as a disability advocate, and I'm so pleased that we have you in our camp and on our side. I wanted to ask what may be a very elementary question to some people, but I was really interested in the fact that you chose to speak in identity first language and that you made a point of that, which I think is really interesting. I'm often finding myself still in fairly, I'll say, heated discussions with people about language and about the use of identity first language. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And I just wondered if you could very briefly explain to us from your point of view, what you perceive or you believe identity first language to be and why it is that you choose to use it?
Of course. I think that's a really great question, and thank you for being so kind. I know there are really strong feelings about language, and one of the first things that I always say is respect the language that a person chooses to use about themselves. So when I use identity first language about myself, I certainly am not saying that that is what everyone needs to use or that any other language is wrong or incorrect. I think that's just wanted to be really clear around that. So I talk about myself as a disabled person because I am, and because being disabled is very much part of how I think about myself. It does dictate lots of things about my life. I am a firm believer in the social model, and I am part of some wider critiques of the social model that talks a lot about the challenges and the barriers that we face as disabled people being all external to us. That is true in my case in some ways, but in other ways, my impairments often are very disabling. And so I think part of why I use identity first language is because parts of my disability are really disabling, and I can have as many accessibility changes and stuff as possible, but there are still days when I'm going to be in bed. So I think for me, that's where I've got to with that. I'm really conscious that some people have very strong feelings about identity first language, both positively and negatively. So I'm certainly not saying that people should only use one kind of language. I know that there was a lot of work for people to reclaim language around being a person first, and that's really important for lots of communities to talk about themselves as a person first, separate to their disability, but for their disability not to be the primary thing that people talk about with them. So and lots of different communities have different language that's really important to them. So autistic people very much, and deaf communities often have very strong attachment to identity first language. So does that help answer your question?
It certainly does. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that, Elle. At BCA, we do use person first language, so we talk about people with disabilities, and again there's always that question, is it disabilities or disability? So I guess it's one of those debates that will probably go on for as long as there are disabled people or people Definitely. With disability.
And look, when I write submissions and stuff like that, when I'm at work, I use person first language, so just to be clear. And like if I'm writing about, say, people with intellectual disability, I know particularly for that community, person first language is incredibly important. Because there are lots of connotations around disabled people for people with intellectual disability that are very different for me as a person without intellectual disability. So I'm very conscious of the different power relationships around some of that language, but also that there's a changing, there is changes around how that language works.
Yes, it's fascinating. And I think, as you say, basically respect the person's choice. So I'd like to thank you, Elle, very much for coming this morning to speak to us. And I think you will have inspired many of us. And I think we'll all feel that with an ally like you or a fellow worker like you with us, that we will have to have more success and it will continue. So thank you so much, Elle. I would like now to move on to our next session, which is going to be a panel led by Vaughan Bennison. And firstly, I'd like to thank Vaughan and Graham for our introduction to our session this morning. They were providing some pre-match entertainment, if you like. I don't know if they had any singing. I didn't hear that. But Vaughan is now taking on a different role now, and he's going to lead a panel session for us on communications technology. Thank you, Vaughan.
Thanks, Fiona, and it's a great pleasure to be able to bring you this session because communications and technology, I mean, firstly, what's not to like about communications? And most of you who know me will know that I'm a very heavy technology user and very strong technology enthusiast. So to pull the two things together seems fairly obvious, really, but from my point of view, it's a really exciting space in which to discuss and in which to work. Let's talk about communications and what communications mean, particularly for people who are blind or vision impaired. And in particular, we've discussed in the last hour or so, and Graham and I discussed this morning, the importance of communication in this current time in which we find ourselves with lockdowns and things moving up and down and, you know, coronavirus happening in all different parts of the country and how we manage that. Communication is really key. Elle's already talked about the lack of communication around disability and COVID response, etc. But BCA has really stepped up and made communication available through all different means using technology. And I guess, you know, we do still communicate without technology, but technology over the last year or so has really made a huge difference in the way that blind and vision impaired people are able to communicate and able to get tips and tricks from each other. Just check on each other and see how we're tracking and all of that sort of stuff. But of course, there are times when communication goes wrong. There are times when technology lets us down and when we just can't get online or we can't speak to our friends or what have you. And that can be for a number of reasons. It could be because of some sort of natural disaster, as per the bushfires that we had early last year. And there are other things besides which can where disasters can impact on communications. And you know, how do we deal with that as people who are blind or vision impaired? What do we do when our communications let us down? So we've got two people who arguably could be said to be experts on communications. And firstly, I'll mention Wayne Hawkins, who is the Director of Inclusion with ACAN. Wayne's been with ACAN, and for those of you who don't know, that's the Australian Communications Consumer Action Network, for quite some time. And he's led a lot of campaigns and done a lot of submission writing and campaign management on disability and communications, particularly with telecommunications. Wayne will tell us more about his work, I'm sure. Martin Stewart. I don't know if anybody's ever come across Martin, but he's a very prominent figure in Blind Citizens Australia and a very prominent figure in the blindness and vision impairment sector. He's been an advocate for many things over many years and most recently is working with BCA as an advocacy officer and receives a lot of complaints and does a lot of advocacy around communications and technology for people who are blind or vision impaired. So let me address my first question to Wayne. Perhaps, Wayne, you could tell us a bit about ACAN and what it does, and particularly around your involvement in advocating for people with a disability and communication.
Sure, thanks, Vaughan. Hi, everybody. It's really great to be back at BCA event. So just for transparency, I'm not in the bathroom. Apparently my microphone makes it sound like I'm sitting in the bathroom. I'm not, so just wanted to clarify that. But yeah, I just want to talk about ACAN for a moment. As Vaughan said, it's Australian Communications Consumer Action Network, and we're the peak consumer organisation in the telecommunications sector, representing the interests and voice of all telecommunications consumers, individual consumers and small business. And as a member-based organization, we have approximately 100 organizational members, and a third of those are organizations which represent the interests of people with disability, disability people's organizations and service providers. So we do a lot of work. We don't do individual advocacy, but we do systemic advocacy across the whole range of the sector. So, you know, what does that look like in real terms? We do a lot of submissions to government, a lot of engagement with the telco industry, which includes both carriers and also internet providers. We do a little bit of work in the broadcast area, but you know, as communications are becoming, well, I would suggest not even becoming, but are already an essential utility, and the way in which there's the convergence of media. So we're, you know, our phones are now providing content, you know, become much more than just the farm. Our work is expanding in trying to meet those consumer interests and represent consumer interests across a much broader range of issues, particularly now, you know, looking at the digital platforms review that the ACCC has undertaken. There's a lot of work there where consumer interests are not represented. So we've been finding that there's a need for, again, to sort of move into those areas to make sure that consumers are protected and their rights are upheld in digital platform space. So that gives pretty much an overall picture. I've been working in the disability area at ACAM for almost, it'll be 11 years in a couple of weeks. On really quickly, and we've done some really big areas of work have been around the National Relay Service, which is probably not something that a lot of people with vision impairment use, but it is a service that is important for people who are both deaf-blind. So there's been some considerable work done in that area. We've made some significant advancements in the availability of information around accessible communications devices through our Accessible Telecoms project, which was initially funded by an NDIA grant in 2018. And that's recently been an agreement to fund that through 2021 has been reached with the telco sector, which is a big... It's been a very long process, but we finally got there. So that's been very exciting. And then there's a lot of areas around, you know, the work with the Royal Commission. We've done a huge amount of work over the last year with regards to, you know, what is the future of telecommunications and communications more broadly look like for people with disability over the next 10 years. So we've got a very big platform of work to do there, and to help us do that, we've recently brought on a new person for the team. And I'm not sure if anyone knows this, but Vaughan has been come on to ACAN as a disability policy advisor. So yeah, that's sort of where we're up to now, and I'm really glad to be here and be part of this conversation. Thanks.
And we'll get into to some more aspects of ACAN's work in more depth as we start to talk about what we can do to make sure that our rights are upheld and to make sure that communication works in the way that that we need it to work. Martin, let's go to you. What sort of complaints do you, as an advocacy officer within BCA, or I guess more generally, what sort of complaints around communications does BCA receive typically?
Thank you, Vaughan, and thank you for all of you for coming today. Speaking from Lockdown City, so we are getting used to it, though. It's the fourth time here. So we're isolated, but still communicating using NBN, as I do, and our telephone services so far are holding up. And that is why we're here today, to talk about the complaints that we receive from you here at BCA. And they are many and varied. We do have a lot about the telephone directory service. And the reason why it's complained about is that since going to NBN, a lot of people were initially cut off from it. And some, using the fringe type services, have been completely cut off from those services. And that when I refer to those, I'm talking about the ones that were for specialised reasons, those who can't read the telephone directory in a traditional manner. And we, of course, ring and get that extra help. Those services are now not well known about when it comes to the overseas call centres. So you ring up the overseas call centre and you say, I've got a new NBN phone. I'd like to be connected to the directory helpline. And they say, what? And you tell them, and they're still not cognizant of exactly what you're on about. And then you go around and round and round circles. I took a long time to get Nine, for example, attached to Optus. And Telstra has a similar issue. We also hear from people about NBN connections, but not as many as what I thought would happen. And that's a testament to the NBN. Congratulations to them. But those that we do receive are quite serious. We receive issues that are related to connecting to the NBN and people being asked, can you see three lights? No, I can't. What colour are those lights? I've just told you I can't see them. I'm a person with blindness. Oh, we're just wondering what colour the lights are. I'm just telling you I can't see them. So this circular conversation tends to occur. And as a result, we then need to ask for a professional install, they say. Even though you may well have the service installed, you just need a bit of extra help, but they want you to help them by seeing lights. So the only way through then, because there's no actual practical course that the telcos can provide usually, is you need to then go into a process of saying, well, I really can't afford an install, and I actually, if you don't mind, don't think I require one, just to try and identify some lights. So if some kind person could come out and just help me along a little bit, that would be okay. Yes, that'll be okay, but it'll be $240. Okay. So you then have to, unfortunately, pull on your negotiation skills, and if you want help, further help after that, you need to call us. And I've been able to engage people with either the NBN or telcos, depending on who it is that's wanting the information, and get that charge withdrawn. But once again, I will say there's not a process that's actually officially in place for that to happen, which is a shame and needs to be fixed. Mm. Now, then we do have issues to do with billing. Now, people using Telstra services may recognise this one, and that is that they are going to what they call simpler billing, where they say everyone's bill will pretty well be the same from the time you get your plan to the time you complete your experience with them. So therefore, there's no need for bills in any other format except email, because you'll be placed on direct debit. Well, we are pushing back against that. At this stage, they are still providing the Braille bills if required, but it's becoming more reluctant, we notice, because they're saying there's no need for all this because it's simplified. Well, simplified it may be, but in Braille, some people still want it to be. But that's where we're going with that one. So we also are concerned on people's behalf about the limitation that is placed upon the disability service departments. There seems to be disability service departments, but quite token ones, because they tell you more about what they can't do than what they can do. So I think it would be a great idea for a dedicated line to mean truly that, and for it to be dedicated to all of these types of issues, a one-stop disability service shop, for example. But at the moment, it's a very limited service, and we think that should be expanded.
Mm. Wayne, we might come to you shortly for ACAN's position on those things, because they are vitally important to a lot of people. But Martin, just before we do that, do you think it's fair to say that as a blind or vision impaired person working having a say in communications at the moment, you've kind of got to be a little bit more technical than the average person, or at least the expectation is that you'll have someone around who can manage those technical things for you?
You know, I'm very big on peers helping peers, and that's helping each other. And before purchasing, whether it be a modem or a service, I think it's worth asking your peer groups who are using those services, what do you think? Is it accessible? Why not, if you say it isn't? Because their reason for it to be inaccessible may not affect you, but you need to know. Forward planning is especially important with communications, because if you can't communicate, well, you're going to be more isolated than even we are in lockdown city.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the lights on the modems, and there are actually ways to get around that by logging into your modem's web interface, which most of them are fairly accessible, but you do have to have a little bit of knowledge about what you're doing. But it's not very difficult, but when you do that, you can often get information like the signal strength of your connection and the quality of your connection and things like that. And that will also tell you if your modem is connected and how it's connected. So, you know, that sort of thing can be quite useful, but it's not a complete answer. What about services like Aira? If you were to use your mobile phone to connect to Aira, is that something that can help in those situations?
Yes, it is. And I believe that Aira does have a service for free that you can make a short inquiry, one per day, I understand. So that is, I actually believe where I live right now, we have to have fire drills because we're in a very serious bushfire zone in the Dandenong Ranges where I live. I actually have a technology drill. So about every 6 months, I will take myself deliberately through the modem settings and just how-tos, just in case of exercises. And it's a very good thing to refresh yourself on all kinds of things that you have in your home with technologies, because you may think you know it because you've on purchase learnt what to do. But 6 months later, when something occurs where you really need to know, you think, oh, my God, I've forgotten. Well, just give yourself a refresher drill, technology drill. Mm.
And also, I think it's important to know who the people are around you who can help. Who would you contact as a first point of contact for, you know, if your internet connection was down? And that differs for every person. Some people have family members who can come and assist. And, you know, some people know how to do it themselves. Some people have a neighbour, for example, who they might get to assist. So, you know, it's important to have that sort of information on hand. But let's talk about... I guess more generally, Wayne, what can consumers do when they have concerns about the way that their telco is treating them and you know, when things aren't working well and they just can't get any traction?
Okay, that was really interesting to hear from Matt and the range of issues that the blindness community face with regards to technology. And just before I answer that question, I think, you know, for many of us, I mean, I'm somebody who is in the technology space, but I'm not very, I'm not a technical person. I'm a policy person. So, you know, when I hear about that, you know, logging into your modem and checking the status sounds really good, but I have no idea how I would do that. And so I'm just thinking, you know, maybe that's something that would be a good action item to come from. This is where, you know, we sit down and work out, you know, what are the steps that a person needs to do in order to be able to undertake that in a safe way. Because, you know, my feeling is always like the more that I fiddle around, the more likely everything's going to stop working. So I think that would be a really good start to be able to do that, because this is an issue that we come out, it keeps getting risen time and time again, and we take it to the telcos and to NBN that, you know, if somebody is not able to do a self-install, they shouldn't have to pay for that because they have a disability. It should be included in the service. You know, and some telcos are better than others with that. But I think it's definitely an issue that we would be keen to work on to make sure that there are options available for consumers. With regards to, you know, what's available, you know, the first point of call is obviously, you know, you call your provider, whether it's your phone provider, your internet provider, and try and resolve what the issues are directly with them. I know for a lot of people that's a bit of an onerous suggestion. We've just recently, Inkins just recently reported, released a report called Still Waiting, and it talks about, you know, the time that consumers spend on the phone trying to resolve their issues with their telcos and, you know, what the potential cost to consumers and the economy from those long wait times, and oftentimes it's, you know, days and days of calling back to try and get things resolved. But in the first instance, obviously, you know, we need to engage with our providers to see what the problem is and if it can be rectified. If there's no resolution from that, then the next step is to take it to the telecommunications and industry ombudsman. And they work as a facilitator between the providers and consumers and will help in resolving issues. You know, but again, that's the second step. And there's also opportunities for for ongoing issues to be raised with organized, you know, like particularly with ACAM. We're not a individual advocacy organization, but these kinds of case studies, these kinds of examples of where consumers are struggling to get redress from their providers or get the information that they need are really, really beneficial for us in the work that we do in advocating for change, both at the government and also at the industry level. So, really, really recommend that if people are having problems, and also to yourself, Martin, you know, if these are issues that you see coming up a lot, you know, just drop us a line, because we work very closely both with industry, government, and also with the TIO to identify what are systemic problems. And then if we've got some good case studies, we can go to the ACMA, the Australian Communications Media Authority, to have them investigate. So there's a number of things that people can do. The rights that we have as consumers are enshrined in the Telecommunications Consumer Protection Code, which it's not easy reading. It's not something that most consumers would look at, but we do have rights as consumers, and they're enshrined in that code to protect interests of consumers.
And there is a reasonably plain English version on ACAN's website where you can see what your rights are as a consumer. Wayne, I'm fairly confident.
Yeah. There's also, we have a number of, it's an area called Talking Telco on the website, and it's got a number of tip sheets around specific issues, you know, how to choose a mobile plan that suits you. What are the different things that you need to think about when signing up for an internet plan? It also does have, what are your telco rights as a consumer? So that's a really useful tool for people, and that can be accessed at the ACAN website. It's acan.org.au/talking-telco. And then we've also got our accessible telecom service, which is an information portal primarily, provides information about all of the telco equipment that's available in the Australian marketplace and what the accessibility features are of the equipment. So it's got landlines, mobile phones, satellite phones, tablets, apps, and the accessories that people with various disability need to be able to engage with those telco products. So that's a really easy to use, searchable database that people can look at if they're looking to get a new phone or looking for a new piece of equipment. The information about the accessibility features is available there. It also tells you, gives you information about what the price point is for those pieces of equipment, and also the most common places where you can acquire those. So that's also a useful resource for consumers.
Martin, I wonder whether you would care to comment. This is just something that occurs to me when we're talking about developing or getting a new mobile plan or even a landline plan. One of the problems that we frequently have as blind and vision impaired people, when we go to establish a new contract with a telco, or I guess there are other providers that fall into this category as well, identity. proving your identity to the extent that they require. Is that something that's still an issue that's faced by a significant number of people?
Some telcos more than others. Telstra in particular are extreme when it comes to what they want. Nothing much shorter than the passport expectation there, and you have a lot of issues in getting your points. There's actually a process. There is an official process which negates all that except for your disability support pension card, but not many of the operators know about it. So it's very difficult to break through and let them know that this different channel does exist in their own company. And that's a real issue in a lot of areas, such as the one I mentioned before with the helpline, the directory helpline. They're just not training the staff. And I know that through the COVID circumstance, there's been a lot of staff turnover, new staff coming in, for example, and they're not giving them the recruitment, which includes disability training. And the overseas call centres, there's some cultural barriers at times. Let's be honest, we have a fairly extensive range of laws that are in place. They mightn't be satisfactory at times, but they're still there that protect our needs, the discrimination laws, etc. In some other countries, and in some cases where the call centre staff are based, we're not at that level. And therefore, the actions and attitudes from the call centre staff aren't at that level. So we need the telcos to understand if you're going to have call centres that are placed overseas, you need to double down on the training and how people with disabilities need to be assisted and supported. So, yes, we certainly have a problem with access to billing information. We have issues with being understood with what our needs are and what we're actually asking. Half the battle is actually establishing an understanding with what we're asking for and why we're asking for it in maybe a more extensive way than what other callers may, because they of course can access the websites. Whereas we're struggling just to get the information to know whether to sign on in the first place, let alone to operate our phones or modems once we do get there.
Just a brief anecdote for you on that, Martin, or for everyone. I was speaking to someone a couple of months ago who, when they rang up a telecommunications provider who shall remain nameless to talk about setting up a mobile phone plan and explained the fact that they were totally blind, the operator said, "I don't believe you because blind people can't use mobile phones." So, you know, that speaks to your argument about training. So,
yes. Now, can I also add to what Wayne was saying about telephones? It's really important that you do the research on what phones are out there, because there is an amazing range of them. I actually went to Harvey Norman and they had a Uniden phone for NBN that was built specifically for older people and people with vision impairments. And it's got large buttons. It's beautiful for me. And there's lots of different equipment and ranges of them that are there. It's just you need to take that little extra time. You might be in this rush world that it is and wanting something instantly. But in our case, if you do that, you can make bad mistakes and end up with a product that you find quite unusable.
Mm. You brought up billing a little bit earlier, and there are some issues around billing. You've talked about the simplified billing from Telstra and direct debit and things like that. But what about people who choose to pay their bills manually? I'll give you an example. Up until very recently, I haven't been able to pay my bill through Vodafone because there's one particular box on the website that says, yes, I agree to all the terms and conditions. And no screen reader that I've found on any device was able to tick that box. So I wasn't able to pay my bill until after I incurred a late fee. I went into a store one day and explained the situation, and she said, well, just get onto our website and pay the bill. And I thought, well, I've just told you that that's not happening and not working. What can we do directly to make sure that that doesn't happen? And are there services that can make these things easier?
Well, there is IRA, as you mentioned before, so we can so we can see those sorts of things through them. But even then, you might be able to tick the box. Often, for example, with my phone, one of the methods I use is I'll unfortunately disengage VoiceOver, tap firstly before disengaging VoiceOver, I'll focus upon what I need to tap upon, and then I turn it off, triple clicking, then tap, switch it back on, and often it does the trick. It's not the best way to do it, as in a way which you would prefer. You prefer to keep VoiceOver on, but it often will activate those buttons. There's also a thing called Screen Reader, which is available, not Screen Reader, Screen Identifier, or words to that effect, a new service through accessibility using an iPhone. And that sometimes can voice up a particular button that's not usually, and then you can tap using that. But I don't like to talk about that too much, and I'll tell you why. Because the more we tell Apple that those sorts of harder to get to areas and functions are useful, the less they'll put into the basic functions of VoiceOver. So it's a catch-22, that one. But it is there, accessibility and voice screen recognition, I think it's called, which you can use, which sometimes can work under those circumstances. Other than that, what I do, I will try to advise people to arrange a telephone channel. So think about the different telephone numbers that your company might provide, and you'll be surprised how some of them you can get through a little more quickly than average. For example, it could be to your local shop, your, you know, say the Burwood store at Telstra. You might happen to strike upon a direct number. They're hard to get, but sometimes if you talk nicely to someone, you can get them. And then you ring them for assistance to pay that bill. So other than that, no, there isn't really. There's just you and your abilities, or you would have to change to a more automated style of payment, which I regretfully say has to happen more often than not these days.
Wayne, does ACAN have a response on billing, or is there anything that ACAN's working on in terms of enabling people to pay their bills in a way that's more convenient for them, or you know, manage those directly with the telcos?
This is an issue that we've been working on ever since I've been at ACAN. You know, there's various changes over time. You know, there was the pay-to-pay campaign where, you know, you were charged if you didn't use, if you were getting a paper bill, you had to pay $2. If you wanted to pay at the post office, it cost you another $2. You know, a whole range of things. And part of this simplification process, you know, that some of the telcos are moving towards is, you know, really takes the control out of the consumer's hands. You know, it's like if you put into, you agree to direct debit, yes, it makes it easier for the most part, but sometimes, you know, when there's an issue, the money just continues to come out of your account and you don't have a service, and it's very difficult to resolve those issues. I mean, my own experience was several years ago, I got a service with a telco and they sent me the wrong modem, and they charged me $200, which was going to be credited to my account. I sent it back. They sent me another one, which was also the wrong one. This happened 3 times, and so $600 had been debited from my account, and that was going to be credited back over time. And, you know, it's like, well, situations like that, it's completely out of the consumer's hands. You don't have any control of your budget and things like that. So that's really problematic. One of the things that we at ACAN have been trying to do is to find a way that's not a direct debit, but to find a way where consumers can pay without incurring a penalty, a financial penalty. This issue of website accessibility has been something that we've just had a grants project, when we run a grants project for the Commonwealth and distribute money to do research for communications products for consumers. And one of those projects is just published last week on the week before last on the Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And it's looking at the five major telcos: Telstra, Optus, TPG Telecom, and Belong and Amaysim, about on their websites, the accessibility of their websites and the ability to use their portals for things such as paying their bills. And that was released, like I said, on the Global Accessibility Awareness Day. So there is work that we're doing, and that project is actually engaged with those five telcos, and they're having a workshop on how to make their websites more accessible. And so hopefully one of the outcomes from that will be issues that, like the one that you've mentioned, Vaughan, will be addressed, and people with disability will be able to use their websites and use their portals and the services that are embedded in those websites with full functionality.
Hmm.
Can I just say something here? The Telstra app, the developers of that should be totally congratulated. They've put in a lot of work to make that accessible. So anyone with an Android or Apple device, I recommend My Telstra. It is pretty well thoroughly accessible. The Optus one, My Optus, that is getting better, not as good as Telstra, but it is getting a lot better. And you'll be surprised what you can do inside those apps that you thought you would have to call about.
Mm.
So, you know, I do that research, I do that technology drill that I referred to earlier. Now, there's one more thing I wanted to add here in this conversation, and that is the increasing ask of the telcos in particular to verify your call through SMS message that they'll send you. So they'll say, just hang on a minute, there's a way we can verify this. And then they send you a message, and you're left trying to scurry to find it in your messages. And you know what it can be like sometimes, having to take it off phone into messages, and before you know it, you might have accidentally cut the call off and you're back to the beginning again. We are talking to Telstra about that through the complaints that I've been receiving. I've been in extensive conversations with them. They are promising to continue a accessible billing method despite going to direct debit. So we expect them to deliver that promise. And they are looking at that call verification service. It's just not the telcos that are doing it. It's proliferating through a lot of services, and it's a real bother.
One of the concerns that I have is that we seem to be increasingly, and we've talked about this over the last half hour or so, there's an increasing reliance on people able to use the more technical aspects or the broader aspects of their devices. What about people for whom that's not possible? So people, for example, with multiple disabilities or people who simply don't want to get involved in reading text messages or getting online and things like that. They just want a standard home phone. You know, maybe they might want to think about getting text messages. Would you say, Wayne, that accessible telecoms is really the best, the first port of call for people in that position? And are there others that we should be investigating?
Accessible telecoms looks at all of the equipment that's available in the Australian marketplace. So it does give a full and importantly, independent assessment of what the accessibility aspects are. I think to your question, though, I think, you know, increasingly this is going to become more of a digital divide, because people who are, you know, unable or not confident to move to the new, more emerging technologies like smartphones and the like are going to be finding themselves less and less able to engage with a range of things, including, you know, government services and and banks and other essential services. So I think it's sort of, it's actually a different issue that really needs to be looked at a holistic level from government. And that, this obviously technology is moving forward and that's not going to stop, but there are a significant number of people who are unable for whatever reason to move forward with that. And this is identified, I think, in the Australian Digital Inclusion Index, that, particularly seniors and people on low incomes, people with disability and people from Indigenous backgrounds are being, their digital engagement is significantly lower than the rest of the population. So I think it sort of brings up a bigger discussion about, what are the alternatives? And what needs to be put in place so that people who don't engage in this new emerging technology landscape, what are their options and how do they continue to be able to contact, services and engage in the community?
Yeah, and I think that's a very worthy discussion. And I think that's being held, or that discussion is being had across the sector. And I think, one of the things I would encourage people to do is to learn as much as you can about the technology that you have access to now, and to try to find a way to understand emerging technologies. And, it can be a lot to keep up with, and some people just simply aren't interested, or some people don't understand it. But there are ways and means, aren't there? There are workshops around for training for particular cohorts of people, but I don't know that there's an awful lot around for blind and vision impaired people. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yes, I think it's a very fair statement. And I think it's something, that potentially, there's a number of organizations. The one that springs to mind is the Be Connected Foundation, which provides digital training resources for seniors across the country. It's a government-funded initiative, and they've recently announced that they got an ILC, NDA, independent information linkages and capacity building grant to provide digital capacity training for people with intellectual disability. So I think, there's opportunities there for, to look at that option for, a number of disabilities. The needs of people who are blind or vision impaired are going to be different from people who have hearing impairment with regards to how they access and use their technology. Similarly, people who are deafblind are going to have a different set of needs with regards to how they access and use their technology. So I think there's an opportunity there for and I'm not sure who's best placed to fill that gap. I mean, ACAN has looked at that and thought about it, and we're not a service provider in that sense. But I think, that kind of program or initiative is something that would be really useful. Possibly it's something like that peer-to-peer assistance that Martin was talking about earlier.
Vaughan.
I was just going to observe that it could be something that the service provider organisations can get involved with in terms of group training for communications and technology and things like that. You might hear more about that at the upcoming BCA Inform session, the partner showcase on Tuesday evening. Martin, you had a comment?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a did you know here, a bit of information. Did you know, Telstra customers, that you can, for example, use your Google Nest device, anything from about 2 years to now, Google Home device, you can use it to make telephone calls. You have to link it, of course, first. If you are with Telstra, they've allowed that, enabled that. I will often make calls using my Google device. I think that is a big enabler, assuming that you have reasonable speaking dexterity. You can make calls in many different ways these days, whether it be with your HomePod, your phone through Siri, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Google Home has been included into that list if you are a Telstra customer now. You have to link your account first, and you may require some help to do that. It is an accessible method, but if you're unsure, grab a friend who's technologically minded and they can help you do that. Don't ring a number, though, that requires press 1 for this or 3 for that or 4 for that, because you can't do that. But if you're ringing a friend or someone that's just a straight call, it's a great service.
Yeah, and there are lots of other connected services around that will enable you to call people. Google Duo is one, you know, you can make calls directly from your device using Siri or Google if you use an Android device. You can do Alexa check-ins and things if you've got Alexas. And my apologies, I just set someone's device off then.
Yes, it was mine. Well done.
And, you know, there's a number of ways that you can communicate, and you really don't have to know a lot about it. And, you know, you can communicate over huge distances and you know, sit and have chats hands-free and you know, make calls very easily. But I don't think that's the answer to everything, and it's not necessarily the answer for every person, because, you know, we already talked about the person who just wants a simple landline phone and has no need for the internet or anything like that. And, of course, all of these methods that we've just talked about rely on the internet in order to work. But I would encourage people who do want a simple method for communication to reach out and have a look at options like that, because they can be very useful and they can be really easy to use for a lot of people. We've got a few minutes left, but I thought that it might be worth very shortly seeing if we have a few questions. And I'm looking not for questions necessarily of an individual nature, but questions of general nature relating to communications and technology. But just before we do that, I wonder, Wayne and Martin, whether you have any final comments.
I just wanted to assure people that we are talking to the telcos about those of the type that you just mentioned, Vaughan, and that is those that have a simple need to simply talk with their simple, old-fashioned device at home called a home phone. And, you know, they've got to make sure that they have the services there for people who, you know, they may consider to be out of date, but for the person, they're right there and in date, because it's them, the individual, and their needs. And they should not be forced onto something that they may not even have the capacity to go to, let alone whether they want to. I think sometimes telcos get it into their heads that the person's just stubbornly resisting and we're just going to force them and eventually they'll get used to it. Some people have, for various reasons, incapacities, which means they'll never be able to get there. And our society should be good enough to consider those people, and our companies should follow suit.
Wayne, any final comments from you? Perhaps you could give ACAN's contact details.
Sure. Just response to Martin's comments then. I think, you know, those are really well-founded and wholeheartedly agree that people shouldn't be forced into things that they're uncomfortable with or don't want to use or can't afford to use. But I think, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, it's a remarkable time, and that the progress that's been made for people across the whole disability sector to be able to engage with new technology is really exciting. And I think if we keep doing the work that organisations like BCA and ACAN are doing to make sure that we bring everybody along on that journey, you know, the future of technology is really exciting and really enabling. And you know, yes, it's going to be a lot of hard work to get telcos to understand that they need to train their staff, you know, to be able to actually assist someone rather than just sell them a phone. But once we keep doing that, you know, it will get better, and, you know, the progress in the future looks quite bright. So I think it is, you know, all in all, it's whilst we've identified a number of issues, a number of problems that still need to be addressed, you know, the technology is providing us with options that, you know, for many years didn't seem possible. You know, and that is a good thing.
I might think of the comment from Romna Callum that said something along the lines of, now has never been a better time to be blind. And I think that's, you know, in many respects, that's very true.
Mark, one of the great impacts of this COVID-19 era is that we are using technology so often now that it's becoming like second nature for many of us. Like, for example, today, a lot of us are using the Zoom service.
Mm, absolutely right.
Stephanie Mitchell has her hand up.
Stephanie, hello.
Yeah, you'll just have to unmute yourself, Stephanie, and then you can ask your question or make your comment.
Perhaps I should take this opportunity to whip through how you can do that. If you're using a computer, you can press Alt-A, or if you're using a Mac, Command-Shift-A. And if you want to raise your hand, it's Alt-Y. Stephanie, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm here. I just wanted to make a comment that one of the ways I've found to get around these overseas call centres and things is to actually use the chat function on their websites. You know, because I do find the accent and that quite hard to deal with. So quite often I'll just go to the chat and I find I get faster and better service quite often if I do it that way.
Thanks, Stephanie. That's a really good comment. Wayne or Martin, do you have anything to say on that?
I have varying degrees of success with that, because often when you go into the chat services, what you write is not what comes back to you. They've completely misunderstood. And sometimes what you're requesting just doesn't translate very well when you're writing. You'd prefer to speak, but it is a good suggestion. Varying degrees of accessibility with those chat services. But thanks for the choice.
And I think it's worth making the point that in some cases for deafblind people, that's really the only option they have. If,
yes,
you know, I guess they could possibly use the NRS or something like that. Wayne, anything from you on that issue?
No, I think, you know, there are options available with chat, the web chat, that are really useful. I think when we start looking at more technical issues and more complex issues, you know, they oftentimes are not capable. For the most part, they're primarily, you know, automated bots. You know, they're using AI rather than a real person. So when things get quite complicated, then, you know, the artificial intelligence isn't up to speed as a person might be. But yes, definitely a useful alternative.
I have I was going to mention chatbots, because increasingly we're seeing those used in a whole lot of areas, and in particular, I had a discussion on the chat service with Netflix some time back about the fact that the latest series of Star Trek Discovery, the audio describe track, was in mono. And I wrote to them and explained this, and they said, you can get audio description by clicking on the audio and subtitle options in the main control panel. I thought, yeah, that's a really useful response. Thanks. Any other questions?
Vaughan, we have quite a few questions coming through, so if we can whip through them, that would be great. Kathy,
we've only got another couple of minutes.
Kathy, if you would like to unmute and ask your question, please.
Yep, I'm asking, I didn't know you could get your modem content on, like, the modem interface on the web. I'm wondering, do you go to your service provider website?
It's a difficult question to answer, Kathy, because there's a huge variety of modems out there. Normally, what I would say is that each your modem will have an IP address on your local network, and so it's important to find out what that is, but that's how you would access that interface.
If I can just say, find out who makes your modem, what company it is, and ring them as well. They might be able to guide you with extra detail.
And many of them have iPhone apps that you can just open, and they will automatically connect to your modem as well. So that can be a really useful thing. Any further questions?
Yeah, our next question comes from Connor Smith. Connor, if you could just unmute and ask your question.
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, sweet. A comment, I guess, is I'm just wondering, I guess, how we go about, or the fact that we need to go about that balancing of consumer choice as well as with what works, because sometimes, as we know, with people with disabilities, you can just be stuck using the one thing that actually does the job, even if there's a myriad of other things with that product or that company that you don't like or you don't want. So sometimes I guess I wonder, you know, how we balance that, because you can end up with a company that maybe provides an accessible service, but then you're spending more money than you would with everybody else in the rest of the community because you don't have that option to just jump around or you get locked in. So that was kind of just my comment.
Thanks for your comment there, Connor. I think, Wayne, you're probably best positioned to comment on that.
I'm sure. I mean, it is a significant problem for some people. I mean, for people who deaf or hearing impaired or deaf blind people who require the use of a TTY to connect with the community, you know, they're pretty much limited to using Telstra or Optus and have no choice in how they in their service providers. You know, there are some useful resources out there. I think, you know, Accessible Telecoms is a good one. There's also quite a good Whistle Out and Whirlpool also have quite good information, although, you know, albeit sometimes sponsored information. One of the things that ACAN's been promoting and not promoting, but advocating for is an independent comparative website for telcos, similar to what's done in the energy space and similar to the ACCC's broadband monitoring scheme. So, you know, we would have an independent place for consumers to go and find out information about different providers. And but I think, you know, at the moment, it's it is quite limited. I'm not sure that there's a place that's completely independent where we can get information around, you know, the range of different services that each of the providers offer.
I'm very mindful that we're due to have a break at 2:15, and I'm anxious to hand back to Fiona. So I think we'll leave it there. But firstly, let me thank the panellists, Wayne Hawkins, Director of Inclusion at ACAN, and also Martin Stewart, Advocacy Officer with Blind Citizens Australia. And thanks to all of you for your questions, and thanks to BCA for allowing us to have this very important discussion. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this topic from BCA in future months. Thanks, Fiona.
Thanks, Vaughan. I'd like to thank you, Martin and Wayne. I think you've all given us lots of things we can go off and explore and start fiddling around and checking out lots of apps and websites, but also some important battles to keep on fighting.